The story of multiculturalism in Canada is, I think it is complicated. I'm not used to speaking about multiculturalism because I actually think it's, the idea of it is kind of ridiculous. But I do think it's important to speak about and how it affects people, because it is a frame by which we see the world, you know? But it is a flawed frame, and it's often not a frame that is properly interrogated. Like, what do we actually mean, you know? Anyway, that's my rant for the day.
So that's kind of it. Do you have anything else to add?
To add?
Yes.
Why are you doing this?
Why am I doing this?
Mm-hmm.
I'm doing this
Hi, my name is Desi. I'm your host. This is Handing the Mic to the Mosaic, the podcast where I talk to music artists of color about the awesome work that they do and how race comes up in their music. And why I'm doing this is a great question. So in the last episode, I got into a little bit about, you know, this topic and kind of trying to figure it out a little bit more. But I guess I should talk about why me specifically, why am I making this podcast? So my mom is Malay and my dad is Indian, and I grew up in Vancouver. Being a mixed brown kid growing up, sometimes how race was talked about didn't always match the experiences of me and other people of color that I knew that I grew up with. Talks of, oh, we're so multicultural, we have so many diverse cultures, but that description kind of stopped there. For example, something I experience quite often is when people want to get to know me, and one of the first things they ask is where I'm from, but they won't settle on me just telling them I'm from Vancouver, even though I was born and raised here. What they want to hear is me talking about how Malaysian and Indian I am. We're just so quick to get excited about cultural diversity, but what about the other part, the we're diverse but part? When I got to university, I found myself wanting to learn more about this idea of us being a cultural mosaic. And as for why this project's about music, I'm just a huge music nerd myself, and I really wanted to talk to some music artists of color. In recent times, there have been a lot of big-name artists of color that have hit international success, such as Nav or Jesse Reyes or The Weeknd, of course Drake, and it's pretty exciting to see these other colored faces putting Canada on the map in terms of music. But of course, I still have my curiosity with multiculturalism, and I wanted to know what was the experiences of people of color who create music in Canada. Do they experience this yay diversity celebration of their work, or is there this we're diverse but moment again that comes up for them too? And if you've listened to my last episode, you probably kind of already know the answer to that. So episode 2 takes place in Toronto, and these interviews were done in December of 2019. Where I talk to 4 music artists about this topic.
We have a responsibility to show that inclusive diversity is a strength and a force that can vanquish intolerance and hate.
So is Canada nothing more than a multicultural hotel?
For me, when we talk about systemic racism, for me, I don't see that in Quebec.
I make music. My music is, I guess it's evolving. I haven't really made music in a long time. I started by predominantly, I guess, identifying myself as a hip-hop artist. I don't necessarily identify myself in that way anymore. It's not that I'm not that. It's just that there are other things going on in the music.
Ian Kamau is an artist, writer, designer, and somewhat hip-hop artist. We sat down and chatted in the Queens West neighborhood at Charles Street Video.
At a certain point in time, I made a conscious decision to write more about myself, what was going on inside of myself and the things that I was experiencing, as opposed to like external topics. I used to write more about like things, like political things, and I just kind of thought they're the same thing, but a personal story is more interesting than a speech. So both of my parents are from Trinidad. They came here in 1970. I was born here. I'm black.
Sorry?
Afro-Caribbean.
My parents migrated from the Philippines in the 70s, and then I was born and raised here, outside of Toronto, in the suburbs.
After a long, exhausting day of getting lost around Toronto, I met up with April Alarmo. I met her in her house, and we caught up in her kitchen as the sun was going down.
And I would say that for sure, like the culture I probably identify the most is being Filipino-Canadian. It's a hybrid, you know, not quite like what Canadian culture is and not quite fully Filipino, but definitely a hybrid from growing up in a culturally Filipino home, but in Canada, well, outside of, in Thornhill, essentially. When I'm in the Philippines, it's obvious, like if I go there and I identify deeply with the culture and I feel like this immense emotion of, oh, this is where I'm from, this is where my parents are from, these are the things I grew up, the ideals and ideas and culture that I grew up with at home. But there's something that's different, you know, I move differently, I speak differently, I like dress differently, and even when I try to blend in, it's very obvious that I'm not from there. Even being able to understand the language and speak it, you know, kind of brokenly, people just know, little kids can tell that I'm not from there. And that makes me feel like, okay, I'm not from there. And then I come here, and growing up here is like, especially in downtown West End Toronto, it's like, ah, I don't belong here either. Like, and playing in a rock band, you know, it's very white in Canada. For the last 10 years, I played in a touring rock band called Hooded Fang. I played bass, wrote lyrics, helped with composition and production, and we toured extensively in Canada, the US, and Europe. And then I also currently, I've been sort of on hiatus with that project for the last year and a half to pursue more of an independent focus on sound art and sound installation. And I also play in an electronic duo called Phaedra, where we used to do vocals and sort of sing-songy rap, and now we're playing more high BPM instrumental music where I play synthesizers and samplers.
Artistically, I am a rapper, beat maker, spoken word artist.
Noise is an MC from Brampton. We met up in U of T's historic Hart House and chatted in one of the stairwells while an event was setting up.
And I also do a lot of work in the community, so I facilitate workshops focused around how rap music and writing rap lyrics can be used as a tool for people that might be struggling with mental health challenges. So I've been doing that for about just over three years now, going into different community spaces and then, yeah, actively recording, releasing music and performing on top of all that. So my cultural background is, my family's from Punjab originally, the northern part of India. They migrated to Canada in the 70s and 80s. So it was kind of like a decade-long process where one of my uncles was the first one to come to Canada in 1970. And then gradually over time, you know, through waves, different family members would come in. And then eventually my mom came first in 1980. And then my dad came in 1982. So yeah, ethnically we're from Punjab, raised in a very kind of conservative Sikh household. Those values, like the Sikh values, Punjabi values, were kind of very prevalent in the household, and they were passed down from the parents and from the other uncles and aunts to myself, my sister, my cousins. My background does tie in to my creativity quite a bit. You know, growing up, even before I was writing music or creating music, you know, I would, like, the traditionally and culturally the Sikh practice is very musical, it is very rhythmic. Like when we go to the Gurdwara to listen to prayers, it's recited to music. And the scripture is all written in rhyme form and in meter, you know? So it has a rhythmic quality to it, it has a literary and linguistic characteristic to it. So from a young age, even before I was conscious of it, I was still absorbing that, absorbing the poetry and the metaphor and the imagery. You know, that kind of just showed me that even though I was raised in a more of a conservative household that said, you know, don't pursue the arts, you need to go to school and, you know, get your grades up, get into a good university, get a good paying job. But, you know, we are from a lineage for centuries of artists and of poets. And I think that just kind of reinforced why I wanted to pursue music even more, because, you know, this is our tradition. And it might be an evolution of it, it might be a different form of it, but it is still, you know, historically what we've been doing for generations.
The last artist I spoke to was DJ SB, and after a couple bumps in the road, we finally found a place to sit and chat. We sat in the basement of one of U of T's libraries.
What I do, so I rap, I don't do anything other than that, so I just kind of show up to the studio and do my thing. Describing my music is kind of like, it depends on the mood I'm in at the moment, to be honest with you. Like, or I don't have like a specific kind of like genre or like way to describe my music. More so, I just focus on the content, which revolves around mental health, relationships, my personal experiences, such and such. So really, I just try to make it as relatable as possible. It really has to do with like what I'm going through at the time. My parents are both from Grenada. I believe like my entire family's from there, except my grandfather was Trinidadian. So Caribbean background. We're not really that popular, I would say, but like a lot of good soca music comes out of there, and they're known as the Isle of Spice. But I honestly don't know much about the country itself. Yeah, I would probably identify more as being from Canada, Toronto. Yeah, I grew up here all my life, West End. So,
Is race something you think about when you're promoting your music?
Not really, no. I know that it is. I feel like more so just like, I try to not make those things bother me, because I know there is that glass ceiling where it's just like, I'm black and I'm gay. There's just so many barriers. And it's not anything that kind of like comes to my mind in terms of promoting my music, especially because I know the demographic I'm trying to reach. Just the youth, black queer youth, black youth in general that struggle from mental health issues. So I'm sure that it wouldn't be a problem. Like, that I'm black. That's not to say that those are the only people I want to reach out to, but I'm sure that when they look at me, they can kind of, that what they're going through is difficult, but like if I got through it, then they could get through it as well.
So my cultural background does come up in my music quite a bit. So a lot of the hip-hop that I was drawn to at a very young age, like the Public Enemy, Dead Prez, Nas, Tupac, like there was always that social commentary in the music. And they talked about their neighborhoods, and they talked about, you know, they talked about Africa. So there was always this link between the present and the past of what it means to be black in America or black in North America. And then as I discovered other artists, you know, looking at like Immortal Technique and Rebel Diaz and, you know, Narsi, all these other artists that were, again, talking about uniquely what their experience was and looking at it from back home but also in North America. So just listening to these guys just kind of showed me that, you know, there is a space or there is value to talking about your experience as openly and as honestly and as raw as you want to present it. You know, just learning more about Sikh history, Punjabi history, it does naturally translate because, you know, that's the culture I was brought up in. And especially for my parents' generation, you know, they left Punjab at a time that was, you know, there was a lot of turmoil politically, there was a lot of state violence. So for them, you know, that's a lot of repressed trauma and unprocessed trauma. And that's not even just with my parents, but, you know, for an entire generation of Sikh and Punjabi people that left Punjab in the 80s and in the early 90s, you know, that stays with you. So there's a lot of generational trauma within the Sikh community, and through my music I feel I've been trying to come to terms with it and try to understand it and present it in new ways for the younger generation as well, because with trauma, once it gets repressed, those stories aren't shared anymore. So what I try to do with my music is same way that Public Enemy did, same way that Immortal Technique did, you know, they talked about what was going on culturally within their communities. I try to do the same thing when I talk about Punjabi and Sikh issues within my music. Again, it's not everything or not the only thing that I talk about, but it does come up quite a bit.
I think everything enriches your creativity, whatever your experiences are. And I think your background is part of your experience. Like, I was raised in a Caribbean household in Esplanade in downtown Toronto. My parents are filmmakers. They made films that were about black people in Canada, not necessarily black Caribbean people, though they were black Caribbean people. And so I think watching stories being told that were about people that were like me and unlike me at the same time when I was growing up made me think a lot more about who I was. Like, if you watch people speaking about themselves a lot, I think naturally you will begin to think about yourself in that way. Like, I never really spoke very specifically about Trinidad or being a Caribbean person. I spoke more about being a Black person in the world. And some of that was informed by a place that I never lived, America. And some of that was informed by Toronto and my experiences in Toronto. And whether or not I was conscious of it, I think there's a, it is a lens. It's a lens. You could be looking through a lens and not be conscious that you're looking through a lens. And so it informs it whether or not you decided to do it or not. But, you know, only recently I've thought, I would like to speak more about Trinidad or what it means to be a Caribbean person specifically, as opposed to another part of my identity, which is probably more focused on my race through the lens of my personal experiences. I feel like I'm more aware of myself than I was before, and I went back and listened to a lot of my old music, and although, you know, being raised by two people that have Caribbean accents, who make Caribbean food, who know Caribbean people, who came here under very particular, like, policies that, I mean, those are things that I didn't know when I was growing up. Yeah, I think at a certain point in time, I started looking at that, being like, I wonder why I never really spoke about that in any particular way. There's maybe one song that is like specifically about the island of Trinidad, but there's nothing else that's really there.
And just even kind of more anecdotally, it's interesting, like when I perform in front of crowds that are more mixed, I tend to get a lot of good feedback, but when I perform in front of crowds that are, or if I show my music to people that are, you know, more South Asian, there tends to be more resistance from the South Asian community, which is odd. And I've had conversations with people, you know, it comes up, it's like, hey, you're a rapper, like, let me see what you got, let me see what you do. So, you know, you play a video for them on YouTube or something, and then the first comment that I always get is, you know, this is good, but I feel like you should try to mix it with like Punjabi music, or, you know, flip a Bollywood sample or something like that. So there's always kind of, at least from the South Asian population, there's kind of like this, I guess, a limited view as far as what a South Asian artist is capable of or what lane they should stick to. And I don't know if I'm consciously trying to buck that trend, but I feel like the music that I create is kind of far from that. So even though lyrically I'm talking about a lot of things that tie into my cultural background and ethnic background, but musically the sounds of it are, you know, East Coast boom bap hip hop. Doesn't sound like anything that could come from South Asia. So there's kind of been, I guess maybe that has kind of led to this, I guess, clash in perspectives between cultures and between generations.
Maybe it's not important. Maybe it's not important to speak about my racialized ideas in my music. I actually don't think it's very important, other than the fact that you can get erased. I don't think people should have to do that. I don't think Black people because they're Black, or white people because they're white, or whatever people because they're whatever. I don't think they should have to speak about any particular part of their identity. They should do whatever they want to do. Whatever speaks loudest to them and whatever they think can relate to a group of people. That's just a thing that has informed my life in such a way where I think it's something that's on my mind. But I don't think I ever made a same thing with the Caribbean thing. I don't think I ever made a decision that I should speak about my Blackness. But in the process of speaking about my identity, my Blackness jumps right in front of that conversation, because it's a thing that informs basically every step that I take in one way or another, and whether I know it or not, it's informing how I move through the world. So I think when I made that decision, naturally, that thing being on my mind, race specifically being on my mind as one form of my like cultural identity, started coming more to the foreground in a way that wasn't happening before.
How relevant is your cultural identity? And then maybe you can also talk about just other parts of your identity to your music.
It's relevant, but I don't want it to be my staple. Do you know what I mean? Like, I love that I could be representative of a certain culture or a certain, like, I'm proud that somebody that looks like me or has the same feelings as me can look at me and be proud that I'm, you know, doing my thing, and that gives them the lane to also do their thing. But I don't want it to be the reason that people like consume my music, or like the reason why people will be on my side. I want it to be because they legitimately enjoy my music, because then it becomes like a politics thing, and like you get wrapped into a box, right? You get put into a box, and there's no way to kind of like be outside of that box, So I would say it's relevant, but I don't want it to be like my entire persona.
So do you think that people's perception of race in Canada, specifically these ideas of multiculturalism, affect how you make music or how your music is perceived?
I think, yeah, it probably does. If I was born and raised in the Philippines and everyone was Filipino, I probably, like, I remember going there and like, purchasing, like nationalism is not something that I necessarily care about, you know? But when I was there, I was trying on this track jacket that was just, like, a giant Filipino flag. And my cousin was like, bakit proud na proud ka? Like, why are you so proud about being Filipino, you know? Which would be different if I was born and raised there, because for sure I'm trying to assert my identity and assert my values and assert what it means to be Filipino and like infuse that identity into the cultural landscape, you know? You just, because it's, you'll still go to movies, you'll still hear music, and you still go to concerts, and there's still missing identities on stage, you know, on screen in music. So yes, for sure it affects that. And I always tell myself, like, or I have been telling myself for 10 years, you know, I have to do this because there's no one else doing it. I mean, there are other people doing it, and there have been other people doing it, but I know them all, you know. There's just, like, a small minority of Filipino artists in Canada, in my genre, in my scenes, and we're all friends, and we all, you know, love and respect each other. But now there's, like, even more artists of color, Filipino artists, and in a way it's like, okay, maybe my job's done and I'm on to the next thing, you know? So I would say for sure that it has to do with it. But I am realizing, okay, when I see older, well, just any older woman who's continuing to practice, like women who are in their 70s practicing their art, their music, their craft, it's inspiring for me. And when I see older Filipina artists who are practicing, who are, you know, changing the cultural landscape, it's inspiring to me. And I'm realizing, like, okay, I actually should keep doing this, because we don't want to abandon the younger generation just because they're there. They still, I mean, this is what I'm imagining for myself. It's still, like, necessary.
So going into more into music now, how relevant is your cultural identity to your music?
That is also a very complicated question, and I would say it's very dynamic, and it's multifaceted. On the one hand, for me, being a Filipina woman on stage playing bass in a very white scene, in a very, like, white genre, which is rock and roll, like, it's white now, obviously its roots come from so many different places, and, like, the relationship between Filipino culture and rock and roll is also complicated. But for me, just being a Filipina woman on stage in that particular environment is already, like, a statement, is already saying, oh, even though your relationship to this genre and your audience is complicated, you can do this too, you know? And when I see younger Filipina women moshing in the front, I'm like, okay, this is what I'm doing. I'm doing this for them, and this is great. And, you know, it's like we empower each other in a way, you know? Without maybe even them realizing, it empowers me. It's not just for them, it is for, like, other young women of color. It's not even, you don't even have to be a woman, it could just be, when you see that person in stage and you can see that they're, like, looking up to you or relating to you, and they are that, like, other odd person of color in the rock scene, it just, like, motivates you and drives you and wants you to keep going. So there's that, you know, there's, like, the physical representation and showing that, like, you can do this because you feel like it, and you don't have to fit in necessarily. And then for me, subtly infusing my identity has always been important, either lyrically or in video. In my electronic project, like, sampling, like, specific cultural excerpts, I think, you know, personality comes into play, obviously, when it comes to cultural identity and art and music. And some of my peers, they're really vocal about their identity, and it's very obvious. I think for me, I'm just, as an artist and overall, I like to subtly infuse things, you know. So there might be a song about being a woman, but you might not necessarily Like, it's not going to be like, I'm a woman, put your hands up, I'm a woman, you know what I mean? It's like going to be a story about a village of women who like take revenge, you know, on men.
In terms of projects like outside of directly music, like what drew you to be involved with those kind of things? Like in terms of just like that making space?
I mean, I we talked earlier about growing up with a very specific image of being Canadian, which was like a whiteness, you know? And again, just like, you know, same thing that you probably hear over and over again, just wanting to be that role model that I didn't have growing up, you know, be that. I mean, when I first came across Kapisana and I couldn't believe it, I was like, wow, like, people who are like me, who care about the things that I do, and they're Filipino, you know, they care about art and music in this like kind of alternative subculture kind of way. It was, I didn't even discover that until my like, you know, early to mid 20s. But now people are discovering that as teenagers, which is amazing, you know, and I would say it's because of the work of the people who are maybe like 10 years older than me who did that. And I'm just like sort of continuing that work. So really it's to inspire a younger generation of people, have them have someone that they can relate to, and basically be that person that I didn't have. And I'm lucky that through Kapisana I did meet like peers who are like myself and a couple of older mentors that continue to like, you know, that I continue to look up to.
What's some of the stuff that goes behind that that people wouldn't usually expect or would be surprised to hear?
I think, again, like, bringing people into my projects, either young women of color, young Filipino women who want to help with music videos, who want to be in music videos, who want to just like learn and participate, and then give them credit, you know, in the public realm, and then sort of guide them and have conversations with them about their own work, you know, be a mentor, informal mentor, bringing a young Filipino queer rapper on tour and having him rap while we play our beats, or have him do his own DJ set. To me, that's like actively, informally mentoring and elevating, you know, younger artists.
I think money has to get back into black labels. Like, black people need to start making their own labels and pumping money into the culture themselves, because we're the only ones that kind of get it.
I mean, I think black people are at the center and on the outskirts of the music industry at the same time, you know? I think contemporary popular music essentially doesn't exist without black people. It's largely evolutions of black American music. The blues, rock and roll, rhythm and blues, jazz, disco, hip hop, house, all kinds of dance music, EDM, all the way up to like trap, you know what I mean? Like, and pop music, which is informed by all of those musics. But at the same time, again, it's like, you know, you have multiple lenses, right? So you go into your little box and you take out different lenses and you put them up. You're like, oh, okay, this is the culture lens. Black people are very powerful culturally in the music industry, right? But then, okay, let's take out the power and decision-making lens. And all of a sudden, everything looks very different, you know? So yeah, me personally, I do feel like I've faced limitations. I think there are a lot of limitations for artists in general. I think it's art as a project is entrepreneurial. It's difficult because essentially to start a business is difficult. Like, to not go into something that already has an infrastructure. Music has an infrastructure. It's just not it's not the strongest infrastructure in Canada. And the more outside of that, of what is viewed as acceptable in one form or fashion, not even acceptable, sellable. The more that you're outside of that, the more difficult that it ends up. The music industry is like the fashion industry. It's very based on, it's based on perception, right? And it's based on attraction and attention. And that attention comes with some things that actually have nothing to do with music. You know what I mean? Like, people will look at someone and be interested in them before they've said anything. And so that comes with the way that people, humans, have constructed, but also the media has further constructed ideas of beauty, ideas of confidence, or ideas of power, cultural or economic or otherwise. And, you know, inside of that thing about attraction or inside of that thing about what is most profitable, you know, so people that are more political or more introspective or more introverted as opposed to extroverted. All those things play into the choices that A&Rs are making or even publishing companies are making or, you know, the people who are going to look at you as an entire package and be like, yeah, but you're not Katy Perry or whatever. Or you're not Beyonce. You know what I mean? So I think the more introverted you are, I think the more experimental you are, I think the darker you are, I think the more critical you are, I think all those things in one way or another actually become not a barrier in and of themselves, but in terms of the industry and the industry's understanding of what people want, which I think is changing now with the internet, but still their understanding of what people want is based on some of those things. You know what I mean? Like if they find some like more or less talented, kind of typically attractive, light-skinned person, that person has more of a chance. Like Beyonce has more of a chance than Jasmine Sullivan, even though Jasmine Sullivan is technically a better singer. Beyonce is more of a pop artist and she fits more of like the beauty standards than Jasmine Sullivan does. And so although it may be like, oh, people just like that, there's all kinds of stuff going on psychologically and otherwise that the A&Rs and the people in the music industry, they actually know, you know? And so they follow the kind of like desire lines towards the thing that they think will be most successful. People's base desires are driven towards looking at certain kinds of people. And because music is so much has moved more away from music and more into just attention because of social media, because of the whole pop thing, because of all that sort of stuff. Naturally, there are barriers for people that won't just do whatever or that don't look the typical way or that don't make the typical kind of music. Pop music is a mass market, mainstream thing. It needs to be accessible with as little barriers as possible to most people. That's why people were so mad when Beyonce got All Black. Lemonade Times and the Beyonce album Times and, you know, the same people that were screaming at Colin Kaepernick relatively recently. Also like, what is this thing where there are all these black women are dressed all in black and they're doing this thing at the Super Bowl? That's not what I paid for.
Like race light.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think some of the limitations with regards to, you know, music and race or music and culture is, I feel a lot of the, like institutionally, some of the bodies that we're looking for to amplify our voices and promote our music, they're a bit behind the times. So for example, a few years ago, I was serving on a jury. I won't mention what granting body it was with, but it was a pretty major one. And there just seemed to be this big blind spot. So it was a jury of five of us together. And it seemed like I was able to contribute my opinions when it came to, you know, classical music, jazz, rock. But anytime it came to a hip-hop or an R&B applicant, nobody else on the panel really had anything constructive to offer. They kind of deferred to me. Mm. They're like, okay, so, you know, so we would go turn by turn on the panel, you know, so each person would have the opportunity to lead first. But anytime it came to a hip-hop artist, they would always say, yeah, I want you to go first. You know, so there's this big blind spot, I feel, and I don't know if necessarily that's, well, I do think that it, actually, now that I think about it, I do think some of that is tied to culture and tied to race, because hip-hop, you know, it is a predominantly black art form, and a lot of the participants in hip-hop now are young and racialized people. So if you're from a classical background, you know, you're going to look down your nose at it because you don't understand it. So I definitely feel from a systemic perspective, there is kind of a lag as far as what young people are creating and what young people are producing versus what the higher-ups see as palatable or see as valuable.
Well, if you think about who kind of holds a majority of the music industry, like the money that gets pumped into the music industry, it's all like white people. So that is huge because there's that disconnect where they don't understand really what people want to consume. They just really go based off like data and statistics and stuff like that. But if you want to make a real connection with people, then it's not those things are going to fade away. It's not going to work in the long run, right? If you want longevity in music, it's when you're genuine and the people can sense that and feel that, and that's going to get you 10, 20 years of fans that are just going to always come out for you and always support you. So there's not enough Black people, Black women, people of color that hold power within the music industry. That is a big issue within our culture.
I don't think your average person thinks about how music gets to them at all. If I didn't have to, I certainly wouldn't. I would just be like, you know, my friend showed me this song and I like it. I wouldn't necessarily think about all the channels that have fanned out in every direction to get that music to us. Or to not just to us, but like to people. And everything that has to happen, all the data, especially these days, all the data, all the market research, all the targeting and all that stuff for you to like something. It just appears in front of you. And you're like, oh, Georgia Smith. Yeah, I don't know. When I have those conversations with people that are not actually inside of music, for the most part, they don't know any of it. So I think in one form or another, all of that is either surprising in some form or fashion for people, but also I think we are very emotionally attached to music and are very emotionally attached to our music and the music that we like and the artists that we like. And I think to say that this person got through or whatever when this person couldn't get through, sometimes people get defensive about that because they're like, oh no, but this person is talented. And I'm like, yeah, that's true, but also there is no the music business is an industry, and it's an enormous network. And one way or another, you're interacting with corporations. Nobody gets big in music without business and technology. Nobody. You could be like, oh, this person just blew up off of YouTube. But YouTube is an enormous multi-million dollar corporation. So yeah, there's streaming. There's all those things are actually being mitigated by actually very complex forces that are constructed by people that all have decision-making power. Like, yeah, it's just the algorithm, but somebody determined the algorithm. Like, you can read statistics, but someone has set the frame for statistics. The statistics will change if the frame changes. So it's not simply like, these are just the numbers, you know? So, and music is it's a mass market. It's not like being a landscaper or something. You know what I mean? Like, if I'm a landscaper, I have a friend who's a landscaper. He's a landscaper, and it's like, summer comes, he's doing his landscaping or whatever. He's working at one house for 5 days, and the person across the street is like, how much you charge? And then he has another 5 days of work, and he's good. Meanwhile, it's like, I spend whatever amount of time doing a song, and I put it out, and I know that I'm getting somewhere between 0.004 and 0.007 cents per stream of that song. Right? I need a lot more people. If that's where my income is being generated from, I need a lot more people to know about that. I don't actually know enough people for that to generate any significant money for me. I've put out songs and made $30, you know? So it's like you have to find other ways to generate money based on the attention. Obviously, it's 2019, 2020. But yeah, I don't think most people that consume music know anything about even how music is consumed, let alone all the different conduits for it to get to them and how some of the most popular people in the music industry are the people, not even the most popular, but the people who would be considered to be successful, who have a career based on music and the things that come around music that you can generate a business from. I don't think the majority of people actually think about that and how things like race, culture, geography, style of music, politics, attractiveness, fashion, you know, technology. I don't think your average person thinks through all of that stuff. I don't even know the half of it, and I'm like in the middle of it, so.
Yeah, the topic of race does come up in media coverage. One instance that did pop up, and it kind of really did rub me the wrong way, is I did a newspaper interview, this was a couple years ago, and the person that interviewed me, you know, we talked about music, we talked about the mental health workshops. This was shortly after I did a cipher with Team Backpack for Brampton, which kind of, you know, did really good views-wise. So there was a lot of good traction from that, a lot of good publicity from that. But the headline, once the article was actually published, I can't remember the exact wording of it, but the first two words in the headline were "Turban rapper does such and such," and I'm just like, and I messaged the author afterwards, and I said, you know, none of our conversation actually talked about race or talked about the intersection of race and music, but you still saw the need to put my background into the headline as a hook. And she even explained it, and she said, you know, when I'm pitching stories to my publishers, they're looking more so as, you know, what is the draw here? What is the hook here? And just saying that we have a really talented artist, that's not enough of a hook. It has to be, oh, he's from XYZ background and he's doing rap music, and or he looks such a way and he's doing rap music. So yeah, that was kind of an uncomfortable realization, I guess.
And so I think it's when people can't, when we have difficulty understanding something or we don't know about something, it's not even on our frame of reference. So when something comes to us from that direction, it's like, I don't even know what this is. Maybe I don't even pay attention to it. And then, as I was saying before, like Canada's music infrastructure was based on like guitar rock music. Maybe classical to a lesser extent. I would probably say to a lesser extent, though I don't have data on any of this, so don't quote me on it. But, you know, a lot of the weekly papers that I'm not even sure if any of those are relevant anymore. The distribution companies, the publishing companies, the places that could fund those forms of music, the conduits for touring, the press in general, not just the newspapers, the PR people, all the people that are involved in the infrastructure of music that are beyond like music makers, managers, and record companies, which is probably the most simplistic way to think about the music industry. But all of those other industries that make up what is the true and fulsome music industry. A lot of those are based on rock, guitar, rock music. You know what I mean? And so there's an understanding. The venues, that would be the other thing. The live venues. Because a pathway for touring also requires places to stop. Hotels, venues, bars, all of those sort of things. They're based on a particular view of the world. And predominantly it was like, you know, kind of, indie rock music. Which is why you could see like a Tragically Hip, a Gord Downie, a Blue Rodeo, or whatever, like those people, Sam Roberts, you know, Feist, be able to be successful touring Canada. Because it's not necessarily simply the major cities, and there is a culture of rock music that is different than popular music, or than hip-hop music, or than R&B, or whatever, where I want to know who the artist is, you know? Where in rock, like, people will just go see a band, not like, who's gonna see a rapper? I'm gonna see a rapper tonight. Who? Oh, I'm just, you know, I heard this rapper was good, so I'm gonna go see him at the local bar with 30 people. It's different, you know what I mean? And so I think that may not be a hard barrier, but it definitely is a kind of a nuanced barrier. It's like I went across the country a couple times touring. And when I went across the country, I always had problems with engineers, which is another part of the music industry. They're like, the feeling was this really isn't real music. I'm accustomed to setting up a 3 or 4 person band, and you're coming with like a DJ, and that's not real music. And so it's fine. And I'm like, no, could we do a proper sound check? They're like, you know, I did the vocals, they're up, no problem, and they're ready to go outside and have a cigarette. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So a lot of artists that ended up being more established, I mean, this is probably a good idea anyway, but specifically for that reason, if you could get to a point where you had enough money that you could tour with an engineer, people would tour with their engineer, so they knew that wherever they went, they got the respect that they deserved. They could get the sound that they wanted and that sort of thing. Yeah, so I think there's all levels of barriers that I think if you haven't necessarily been through the process of doing it, you don't understand what you're really dealing with when you meet some guy in like, you know, skinny jeans with kind of gray hair and a rocky haircut with a leather jacket, and he's like smoking a cigarette behind the mixing board, and he's telling you, yeah, no, it's fine, I turn the mic up, it's fine, I'm gonna go out and whatever, you know what I mean? Then you know, maybe you don't kind of understand what you're actually dealing with, you know? But rock culture and hip-hop culture is different culture. A musician that doesn't respect hip-hop is not going to give you the thing that you need. An engineer is not, often it becomes a problem, not all the time, but often it becomes a problem. And then there's layers and layers and layers of that if you're doing something like touring or trying to release music. Because now, I mean, especially back then, you have to deal with a manufacturing company that doesn't necessarily understand where you're coming from. You have to deal with a recording engineer or a mixing engineer that doesn't understand where you're coming from, both in studio and in venue. Maybe you're looking for distribution companies, and the people that are connected to those distribution companies are looking for a certain kind of thing, and you are not that, because they're looking to pull certain kinds of music out of that. The record companies, but also the distribution companies and the publishing companies and all the places that you would actually make money in the sale of your music that is beyond simply your audience. But then also the press is a conduit to your audience. Word of mouth is a conduit to your audience. And all of that comes with framing that if you're not respected, or if people are not interested in that, or if, quite frankly, they're outright racist, you're not going to have access to any of that. So the majority of artists, black artists from Canada that have been able to do well, they leave. They leave. We're 4% of the population of Canada, something like that, black people. You know what I mean? Maybe 7-8% of Toronto, which is one of the most diverse cities on the face of the planet. And there are more than 350 million people in the United States, and a larger black population there, and a long history of a black population being there that actually had to create its own infrastructure. Like the whole Southern America black music scene was essentially on its own. It's like you could go to Jamaica and do reggae, and there's a whole infrastructure that's just about reggae. You don't actually have to go through any of the mainstream stuff. You can be a pretty substantial level of an artist that doesn't necessarily interact. But we don't have anything like that here. There's not really enough of us. It's too difficult, and we're also next to a giant. People usually go to New York or LA, or depending on what they're doing, Atlanta. Or if they're more like abstract, they may go to London or Berlin or one of those sort of places. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But it's an interesting idea that you could stay in Toronto and do it, but the reality is all of our biggest artists, all of their infrastructure is American.
Yeah, I think musically, depending on the subject matter, there is kind of a worry if I make a song that is, you know, specifically about something Sikh-related or Punjabi-related, that the broader Canadian media might only perceive it to be for a South Asian audience. So it does sometimes pop up in the back of my head that, oh, this might get pigeonholed, even though that's not my intention for it to just reach one specific audience. And even, for example, like recently I was writing a grant application for a project that is, you know, very closely tied to my family history and, you know, my cultural background. And again, just because of my previous experience serving on the jury for the grant, in the back of my mind, I just kept thinking that, you know, is this going to be seen as worthwhile? Is this going to be seen as having merit, even though culturally it is very specific? So I feel like even though we talk about multiculturalism, talking about celebrating diversity, we still do sometimes, as artists, run the risk that if we try to celebrate our own selves and celebrate where we come from, it might get boxed in or pigeonholed as not being, you know, palatable for wider consumption.
So when you give other groups of people, not just white people, but if we are talking about white people, if you give white people music that they love, and you give them Chuck Berry, and then you give them Elvis Presley, they'll be like, when I wake up in the morning, I see Elvis Presley in the mirror, and I am attracted to that. Now that can get blown way out of proportion to the point where you're like, Elvis Presley is the king of rock and roll. You know what I mean? Like, he was the person that made this. And that's not true. But I understand what it means to wake up in the morning and to see a person in the mirror and to want to see yourself reflected in the world. So I think there's a needle, like everything else, it's on a spectrum, right? I think when that needle gets too pushed in one direction, it ends up being something that's actually very toxic, right? Racism is a toxic version of an identity thing that's going on. But I don't think that means that identity thing is by nature a problem, but I do think it is something that should be balanced. Like if I see Andre 3000 and then I see Feist, or whatever, I shouldn't be like, I have to relate to Andre 3000 because he is black and male and relatively around my same age, and we dress, well, we don't really dress the same way, but you know what I'm saying? And I don't relate to Feist because she's white and female and all that sort of stuff. I think once it gets into that territory, you start blowing things out of proportion, and now you're in the territory of racism or homophobia or gender bias or whatever the situation is, and then it becomes a problem. But if you just want to see yourself, you should be able to see yourself. The problem is you're in a culture where the majority of people actually don't look like you. Maybe not in Toronto, but in Canada, the majority of people are not people of color still. And so that means that that majority comes with a power, with a connection to power. And when you say something needs to be mass marketed, as music does, and you're in a situation where the majority of people in a particular place are white, that means something for people that don't fall into that category. And that maybe the industry is critical about that. Chances are the industry is not critical about that. And they're just like, we just need the most people possible. And so they'll put it in the frame of, there's an attractiveness, there's a talent, you'll hear the word relatable often, right? Relatable is a code word, right? It means a very particular thing. Whether the people that use it know what it means or not, that's what relatable means. It means I can see this person and I can see myself in this person. In North America, largely in the Western world, and really, in many parts of the world, that relatable person, the archetype of that person, is like Brad Pitt. And everything is being compared to like Brad Pitt and like Angelina Jolie. Maybe the majority of people that are interacting with that can't unravel all of the complexities of race and history and colonialism and economics and all that sort of stuff, but it is still present inside of those small decisions to like make, you know, Elizabeth Taylor the Queen of Egypt or something, you know? So I just think it's way more complicated and nuanced than the reality of what it actually is.
So is there anything else you wanted to add?
Not really. It's just an interesting conversation to kind of bring about. Without people of color, immigrants, black culture, like Canada wouldn't be as, the world wouldn't be as fun as it is right now. So it's important to speak up about like the misconception of what's going on in Canada and like how we can kind of shape the narrative differently from it being like Canada's this nice place versus Canada is, yeah, pretty cool, but like there's still things we need to work on and fix in our home, right?
Is there anything else you wanted to add to like all of it?
I hope that made sense and was helpful because I feel like this is stuff that I've been talking about for so long, you know, in my artistic practice, that it just feels old and it feels... Yeah, it just feels old to me and it feels repetitive, but I guess it's still important and it's still something that people don't think about necessarily. Yeah, I think it's cool that it's changed, the landscape is changing. I think that there's more artists of color doing their thing. I think that it's funny because I would say the younger artists are infusing identity even more into their work than I have been. And... yeah, I think it's just like an interesting time to be here on Turtle Island. I think it's an interesting time to be a person of color here and to be an artist here. And that it's, you know, I think I'm sad that I can't see what it's going to be like in 300 years because it's going to be even more exciting and integrated and interesting. And it'll be cool to see what like even younger generations do with their art and their identity.
And that wraps up episode 2. Thank you to Ian Kamel, April Alamo, Noise, and DJ SB for chatting with me. If you want to find out more about these artists and the awesome work they do, You can take a look at the episode description where I've included links to their work. Before heading out, I want to send a big thank you to Professor Alessandro Renzi, Professor Owen Chapman, Professor Vivek Venkatesh, to my friends Becca, Patricia, and Kevin. Thank you to Charles Street Video for offering the interview space. Thank you to the Feminist Media Studio for the equipment, and as always, thank you to Josh for your endless editing help. And with that, I'm signing off. Until next episode.